It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Violence is an ongoing issue for many Wisconsin cities. Last week, Madison's police chief announced a new initiative aimed at reducing violent crime. The Beloit Daily News yesterday published an editorial calling for more community efforts to end violence. And high-profile shootings in Milwaukee have raised the urgency of the issue there.
But what actually works? Our next guest has been calling for a different approach, applying a contagious disease model to the spread of violence, then working to stop the spread of that contagion. Dr. Gary Slutkin joins us now. He's an epidemiologist at the University of Chicago at Illinois, and he's the founder and executive director of Cure Violence. Dr. Slutkin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
So you've worked on epidemic infectious diseases, things like tuberculosis and AIDS. What led you to see violence as something that could be studied and maybe treated in similar ways?
Yeah, it's exactly what you're saying. So my background is having worked on other diseases that spread, like tuberculosis and cholera and AIDS. And by working on them, I was able to see what was required to prevent things from spreading. And then through AIDS is really where we worked with World Health and others on really learning about behavior, in that case sexual behavior, in this case violent behavior, but really learning about behavior and how behaviors are actually formed and how they're really changed, what keeps them going and how they're changed. And so when I moved back to the States, a lot of people started to tell me about the violence, and I was asking people, what are you doing about it? And what people were telling me wasn't making a lot of sense to me, because in the world of behavior, as epidemiologists and medical people and even social psych people now, we're very aware that that punishment is not the way. It's an old way of thinking. It does not actually help. And it's not a main factor, in fact, in causing behaviors to form or change. So this reliance, it's an old and extremely old way of thinking. And then I was just looking at graphs and charts and maps, and I was seeing the same characteristics that we see for other contagious diseases, this clustering in various neighborhoods, the way that the curves move as in epidemic ways, the way they rise and fall and how they form waves. And also, you know, even on the street, people themselves know, you can see, we can see in cities how one violent event leads to another event, which leads to more. And some of this is this exactly the way that flu or colds or TB, you know, it's one causes another. And this is actually definitional. This is how we define a contagious disease, is when the risk factor for it is itself, not other things. The actual risk factor for violence, the greatest predictor of violence, is a preceding violent event.
I want to get into that point a little more. I understand with a virus or bacteria that exposure to it makes you, you know, at risk of catching it. But are the numbers there? Being exposed to violence is the most serious risk factor in committing violence later?
It is the single most important factor. This was a clue to me. I was asking, what is the greatest risk factor for a single violent event? It is a preceding violent event, exactly the same answer as you get for flu or for colds. But also, in a different set of studies, in a different way of looking at it, when you see places that have all the things that everybody complains about poverty and lack of enough father, poor education, all of these things, and if violence isn't there, those kids followed 5-10 years later, they themselves don't do it. But if you find the kids who have been exposed, same term, exposed, either it's been done to them or they've seen it, they've seen a lot of it, then they have the risk factor of doing it. They have the probability of doing it. That's 30 to hundreds of times higher. And even more to this point, there's a relationship, a biological relationship. In other words, the more you're exposed, the more likely you are. The more times you've seen it, the more times it's done to you, the more likely you are to do it in the future. which is the same for flu. The more exposed you are, the more of it you've seen, you've had around you, the more likely it is. So it appears, because people are seeing it as a behavior, it's just that the brain is processing the exposure the same way that your lungs process exposure to TB to cause you to cough, or the intestines process cholera to cause you to have diarrhea and produce more of itself. The brain unconsciously produces more of itself, dependent on how much exposure there's been.
Well, you use the word biological, being exposed to violence, witnessing it, being a victim of it, committing it, actually changes our brains in ways that make us more likely to commit violence in the future?
Your brain normally manages whatever it's been exposed to in a copying way. The brain is a copying system. There's cortical mechanisms for this. Some of this is called mirror neurons, and some of it is more complicated than that. Additionally, doing what other people do actually follows dopamine pathways. And avoiding the disapproval of your friends follows pain pathways. And then there's the business of trauma. Having been traumatized causes you to be hyperreactive and hypervigilant. Like, what are you looking at me for? Or reacting too quick. And so these three systems, this copying system, and the dopamine system of being anticipating what you, the rewards your friends will give you, and then this trauma, these three systems work to produce more of itself. In other words, we know even the biological underpinnings of how copying and imitating goes on, and it's largely unconscious. And this explains so many things. It explains, for example, why, you know, when crime has really gone down, a violence has really gone down, criminologists and others say we don't know why it went down. Because it isn't tracking the things that they're imagining that cause it. In other words, you know, poverty and all these things. It's coming down because it went up, because it's following the basic epidemic curve of, you know, not enough susceptibles around. And there's kind of math involved with this.
So if we're treating violence as an epidemic and using this model of contagion, how do we intervene? How do we break that cycle?
Completely differently. We go to an epidemic control model, which means that you need workers who can detect and interrupt first events, who have the trust and confidentiality and respect and access to the population, so that the population doesn't move away and have negative behaviors, but is attracted in the way the health system works. So we have violence interrupters now, and they are people who have a very good access to the population who's doing it, because they have similar backgrounds. That we do the same thing for the way we control HIV. We have outreach workers who can access people who are having a lot of risk sexual behaviors. It's the way that we access populations who have a lot of diarrhea or pneumonia, who are refugees. We hire refugees to reach them, and we look for first cases and then prevent spread. So there's violence interrupters, and there's outreach workers, and there's program managers, and this is a parallel system to law enforcement, but it's a system that is one that interrupts and changes behavior in the positive way. It's a lesser arrest, a positive behavior change system. It becomes a network.
So when you bring someone on board in a community, in a city, say Chicago, I know there's some work that's gone on there, and they volunteer to be a violence interrupter, what kind of training do they get in intervening to stop those first instances of violence?
Well, anyone can, you know, kind of pick up the skills to, in a way, prevent actions of their friends and kind of, you know, in a way, volunteer to be helpful to your friend to not make mistakes. But the work is not a volunteer work. The work itself is not. In other words, you can talk to your friends about their sexual behavior, but the work of reducing HIV in a community is done by health workers who are paid. So this is a new workforce, a parallel workforce, and they're recruited and selected according to various characteristics of trust and access. But the training, which is the other part of this, involves understanding this model. It requires people to learn how to cool people down. And there's a lot that goes into that, having to do with validating their complaints, a lot buying time, buying more time, and then starting to help them get off the hook socially, which is one of the reasons why they're doing it, because they think their friends expect them to do it. So there's a 40-hour training system before anyone becomes an interrupter or an outreach worker in the Cure Violence model. I'm really talking now about the Cure Violence model, which is kind of the cutting the edge on epidemic control and the health way of reducing violence. So what we do in Cure Violence in Chicago and Baltimore and New York and Kansas City and New Orleans and Philadelphia and a lot of other places is we carefully select and then train in these methods of detection, interruption, behavior change, and then gradually shifting norms. And then this is a continuous process, just like, you know, outreach for other health fields is a continuous process.
We're talking to Dr. Gary Slutkin. He's founder of the group Cure Violence. He's an epidemiologist, and he says it is more productive to think of violence in, say, our cities in the United States like a disease, and treating it that way can help us stop the spread of violent crime.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your observations. What do you think about this idea of treating violence as a contagious disease? Do you live in a violent neighborhood, or maybe you have in the past? What do you see that needs to change? You're working with anti-violence efforts in your community, and what are you trying? What works? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We continue our conversation with Dr. Gary Slutkin. He's an epidemiologist and the founder of Cure Violence. He says violence spreads like a contagious disease, and that could be the key to reducing violent crime in American cities.
You can join in now with your questions about this concept and how crime prevention would work with it in mind at 800-642-1234. Or maybe share your observations. Have you lived in a city with a problem with violent crime? What do you think works to prevent it? What doesn't work? Are there things we're doing now that are just replicating past failures? Call 800-642-1234. And if you're in law enforcement or the legal system or community organizing, interested in hearing your perspective as well. Again, 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Dr. Slutkin, you had alluded to this earlier. There was a big change in disease prevention from a moralistic model to a scientific model of treatment. That's what you're calling for here in violent crime prevention. Are we ready to hear that? Are we going to be able to separate it from our moral attitudes toward crime and those who commit it?
Yeah, I think we're about ready to. It might be hard because it's kind of stuck in a way, but we've been stuck with problems before, treating them moralistically rather than going at them scientifically. I mean, this is, of course, the history of a lot of other health or medical issues. I mean, we historically thought that people who had leprosy or plague or TB were bad people. You know, how else would they get it? Why else would they do this? And certainly we have emerged from that because now we understand invisibly there are microorganisms and that's what's going on. I mean, we now understand mental illness differently, not as something with demons or bad people, but as a brain process. People with seizures and you know, people with epilepsy, they were thought as being bad people. Now we understand that it's brain process. And we did a lot of counterproductive things when we were looking at any of these problems moralistically. In fact, the moralistic lens has failed to solve virtually anything. I mean, you have to tell me really what's been solved in that lens, whereas like the health view, and now we have so much more information in the last 15 years. You know, the idea of violence as a contagious disease or a contagious process, and the brain understanding of this now and how it's picked up. This is really, this has been worked out. There have been dozens of studies now, and we've summarized hundreds of studies, actually, in the Institute of Medicine report on violence as a contagion. And even more importantly, the approach of treating it in this way is now showing results by all kinds of independent long-term and short-term studies that have been done by Johns Hopkins and by the CDC and even by the Justice Department. They've also validated the health approach and the disease control or epidemic control approach. So it's just, you know, the general public is next. I mean, New York City, you may know, their health department, their mayor, their city council just tripled the cure violence approach. It's expanding in Baltimore and Kansas City and in New Orleans. So it's coming. And it's in also in other countries in Latin America. I mean, some of my staff are working there right now in Mexico and Colombia, and this approach is starting to take shape there, too.
We'll bring in a caller now. It's John with us in Windsor. John, hi.
Hi. You know, I think there's a great theory. However, I think that you also have to take a look at the economics of this whole thing. You know, violence and crime increases during economic downturns. And until you provide opportunities for individuals, especially individuals in the inner cities, where they can be successful, you will never get rid of crime and violence, because people are desperate, and they will do desperate things in order to survive. And I think that although he is correct, that I believe that there is a tendency, especially in white middle and upper class communities, for this to occur. When you're talking about the economically deprived, I think that this is that's a totally different thing.
John, thanks for the call. Your thoughts on that?
Well, thanks for the call, too. I mean, it's an important call because a lot of people feel this way and think this way, and it's kind of common idea, but it doesn't actually follow in that way. There was a giant epidemic downturn in 2008, and violence didn't go up in most places. This is like it's not followed in that way, and some of the poor places in the world, like in Bangladesh, and you know some places in Indonesia that are very poor, poor India, and so on, they don't have rates of violence as much as other places. So it doesn't really track. Now it is the case. As I say that, there is an enhanced susceptibility to violence in situations of extraordinary inequity. Inequity is kind of the dirty water for, as dirty water is to diarrhea, inequity is to violence. However, we were able to drop rates of diarrheal disease when we couldn't actually clean that up. And that's the same thing we're finding here, is that you really can drop it. And when you do drop it through a disease control approach, then other things start to get better. I mean, actually, the World Bank has made a giant shift on this. They have been trying for decades to, quote-unquote, develop their way out of violence. They've not been able to do that. And so they dragged themselves to now seeing that they have to reduce the violence in order for there to be economic development. It actually goes the other way. And this was really the research of Paul Collier, who is the chief economist at who wrote the book The Bottom Billion, who was the chief economist at World Bank, is that it really works the other way. You have to reduce the violence in order for people to be able to get out of poverty.
As we wrap up, briefly, if there's a city leader, police chief out there, whatever, who wanted to do this cure violence method, how would they get started?
Well, it really starts with the best way for it to come is through the health department. It's the health department in New York and Baltimore and Kansas City and other places that are doing this. And there are, I know in Wisconsin, there are very good people in emergency rooms. Stephen Hargarten, I know, is one. And there's people who are doing parts of this, who understand this very well. But it needs to be brought to a certain level of integration into the government. So, I mean, Cure Violence, which has its training unit in Chicago, and we're happy to hear from cities there. I know that there's a need, and there's the way to contact us is through our website, cureviolence.org, and the way to learn about it more. But I know there's a lot of really smart people and really good people in the area who could build this out.
Dr. Slutkin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye. That was Dr. Gary Slutkin. He's founder and executive director of Cure Violence and epidemiologist at the University of Illinois at Chicago.